Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
LMFM Podcasts. With CNC Carpets, we bring the showroom to you. Or you can book a personal consultation at our fabulous new showroom in Moortown, Dromiskin. Call 087-660-40-237 or visit our website at cnccarpets.com to book an appointment. CNC Carpets, for all your carpet and wood flooring needs.
Hello there, good afternoon. You're welcome along to Wednesday's Late Lunch. This is Barbara Scully with you once again. Listen, the first question I have to ask you is, are you watching the Bake Off, the Great British Bake Off? Tis on of a Tuesday evening, makes my week. I love the Great British Bake Off. It's perfect winter or autumn. We're still in autumn. Don't get ahead of yourself, Scully. It's perfect winter watching. It's like being wrapped in a big warm hug. And I mean, it's a competition, but I guess the Bake Off must be the only competition where the competitors actively help each other and are nice to each other. I love it. I love everything about it. And I also love the commentary that goes on Twitter while the programme's on, because it can be very funny. So last night was biscuit week. Not, it has to be said, one of my favourite weeks. I'm a kind of a dessert, loads of cream, gooey things kind of person myself. So biscuits, I always think, a bit boring. But anyway, they started off and they were asked to bake macarons. And this caused major confusion. Macarons. What's a macaron? And is it the same as we used to say, growing up in Dublin, a macaroon? So there was great crack on Twitter until somebody posted a very, very helpful kind of graphic, which showed us that what they were being asked to bake was a macaron, which are the French yolks, which are kind of crusty on the outside and a bit gooier on the inside. They come in all kinds of generally pastel colours. I think they're awful. They're kind of too sugary for me. A macaroon is the coconut yolk. And then obviously a macaron, well, that's the president of France, which has nothing to do with biscuits whatsoever. Although it's quite tasty as well. Can I say that? Is that a bit sexist? Anyway, it was very educational. But the second biscuit that they were asked to cook in the technical challenge got me very excited, because they were asked to make Garibaldi biscuits. Now, who remembers Garibaldi? I haven't seen a Garibaldi biscuit in decades. They used to be called also the dead fly biscuits. You know that they're like flat ones and they have currant-y bits in them, but the currants aren't full, so they look like squashed flies. And we used to call them the squashed fly biscuits. But this is what they made. Now, they kind of wrecked them a little bit because they were told to put chocolate on half them. And I never met a Garibaldi that had half of it covered in chocolate. But it made me realise that I miss Garibaldi biscuits. And I am now on a mission to find anywhere that stocks Garibaldi biscuits. Are they in your local store? Because they're sure as hell not in mine. And then it got me thinking about, and I probably get fixated about biscuits more than the average person because I'm diabetic and I shouldn't eat biscuits at all. So I tend to dream about them more than eat them. But got me thinking back to the other biscuits that I used to love as a child, were Marietta biscuits. Who remembers the Marietta sandwich that you used to get with your two Marietta biscuits, your butter in between the two? We obviously never used to put butter in the fridge because you'd be able to squish them down then and the butter would squeeze out through the holes in the Marietta biscuits like little buttery, delicious worms. Absolutely fabulous. So I went to bed last night dreaming of biscuits, and I'm still thinking about biscuits today. So if you know, first of all, I have two questions for you. If you know where stocks Garibaldi biscuits, you need to let us know. That's very important. You need to let me know. But anyway, we need to know. That's very important. And secondly, I want to hear from you. What biscuits do you miss? What biscuits did you have in your childhood? Well, maybe they're still around, but maybe they're not still around. I mean, you know, I'm thinking of, do they still do those, what do they call them, Kimberly Mikados? I don't think they're still around with the coconutty bits on the top of them. But anyway, let me know. What's your favourite biscuit? What do you like to have with your cup of tea? And particularly, what was, if there was a biscuit that you had when you were growing up and that's not available anymore, what do you weep about not having any longer? Let us know. Get in touch. Send us a text or a WhatsApp to 086 1800 658. These are burning questions that I'm needing answers to today. Anyway, enough of that and down to business. Meath County Council are urging people to avoid using so-called backyard garages after having to clean up almost 120 discarded tyres and car parts which were dumped on a rural roadside. Joining me now to talk about this problem in Meath of illegal dumping is Alan Nolan, litter warden with Meath County Council. Now, Alan, before we talk about the serious issues of illegal dumping, I have it on very good authority, namely Louise, my producer here, has told me that you are a baker par excellence and an expert on all things biscuits. Would that be correct?
I wouldn't say. Okay, for the sake of Louise, I'd agree with her.
wise man.
Wise man. I wouldn't be a huge, huge biscuit eater, but my good friend Noel Fleming and his wife Chrissy, I have to say, I have a very, very soft part in my heart for Chrissy's cheesecake.
Ooh.
I'd be like you. I'd be more dessert than
desserts.
Biscuits.
Yeah. So are you Chrissy. Telling me? Are you telling me, Alan Nolan, that when you have a cup of tea, you don't have anything with it? Unless there's cheesecake going.
I wouldn't drink a lot of tea now either, to be honest.
Oh, for God's sake.
I'd be a coffee man, but I would be partial to a ginger nut dip in a jelly.
There you go. I knew we'd get to the real deal. Ginger nuts.
Yeah. Just if Louise cooks biscuits for you, just tell her they were nice. Don't eat them.
Right, you're a braver man than me, but I'll bear that in mind. If she comes in bearing biscuits, she's obviously trying to kill me.
Well, she got them off someone.
Well, that'd be safe enough then. Listen, back to the serious business. This 120 discarded tyres, tell us a little bit, where did that happen and what was that about?
Just outside the village of Kentstown, and beside Danestown Cemetery, if anyone knows the area, it's a small little rural road where the local residents do an absolutely fantastic job of keeping the grass verges tidy, clean. And in appearance, it's probably one of the prettiest little roads you see in County Meath. And unfortunately, last week, I probably can't use the language on air.
No,
I won't
don't.
Use the language on air.
No.
UIFs, as I call them, and I've always called them uneducated, ignorant fools, decided to drive down the road, obviously a little tipper truck, and in the middle of the road just spilled the whole lot out into the road. There was car parts, 117 car tyres, car parts, car jacks, trolleys. We believe, and it's hard to say, but there is a lot of backyard garages out there, we call them. They're unregistered. They're not registered with Repack ELT for their tyres. They must be also registered to get rid of their waste oils, their battery acids, their fluids, their windscreen washer fluids, all that sort of stuff, brake fluid, clutch fluid. They're not registered. We don't know if it was a garage or a garage gave it to someone to get rid of them. When you buy a tyre, Barbara, if you go to a tyre company that fits tyres and that's all they do,
they pay
€2.80 plus the VAT to Repack ELT. That covers the cost of taking back the tyres. When they have enough tyres, they'll ring the company and say, right, we have 100 tyres here, we need them collected. They're paid for.
Now, right.
That cost is passed on to you when you buy your tyre. They're doing it correctly. They're open to inspections at any time from Meath County Council, from the EPA and Repack ELT.
Right.
But a lot of these, like, you have a fella there with a garage inside the house, we think they go up north, buy tyres, they don't have to pay the ELT charges up there, they'll bring them down, and then all of a sudden they're looking outside the shed, there's 30 or 40 tyres, God, how am I going to get rid of them? It's going to cost me €5-6 to get rid of the tyres. They're obviously giving them to someone, or else themselves driving out the country, and the gallon drums of oil, the 5-gallon drums of oil, the 45-gallon drums of oil, they're bringing them out, they're dumping them, they're giving them to someone, they're getting it at a cheap rate, rather than pay €200 going to get them done properly, they're giving them to these guys that are on social media advertising to pick up rubbish. They're probably paying them 50-60 quid. This is where they're ending up on the side of the road.
Good Lord. So you're telling me that we as consumers already pay a tax, if you like, on tyres when we buy them from a registered tyre place that covers the cost of getting them recycled correctly?
It's like your weed, the electrical.
Yeah.
When you're going to buy an iron,
there's
€2 or €3 put on the price of the iron. You don't know that, but it's there. It's put onto it. And that's all the recycling of electrical products is free because of that fund that's there. It's the same with tyres. It's free. They're free to collect from the end user, as we call it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, people operating, we'll call them illegal.
Yeah.
because that's what they are. They're illegally operating a garage without being registered for the likes of their waste oil, their waste fluids, their waste brake fluids, clutch fluids, petrol, diesel, tyres, batteries, all of that sort of stuff. And it's ending up on the side of the road.
Yeah,
there is some great guys out there doing great work. But, like, people need to think about, okay, if I'm going to Johnny down the road, he's taking two tyres off me, are they going to end up in a bonfire? Are they going to end up, where are they going to end up? Are they going to end up on the side of the road?
So what you're saying to us is that we all have a responsibility to ensure that, number one, when we're buying tyres, that we're buying them from a reputable place. And number two, that if there is somebody offering to take away your old mattress, which I think is another issue, or tyres or whatever else for, you know, 50 quid, you've got to make sure that they are a registered operator who are going to get rid of things in the correct manner.
And don't be afraid to ask your garage man or your register with ELT to get rid of your products correctly.
What's ELT, Alan?
It's the Repack ELT. It's an organisation set up by Repack that all these manufacturers and garages and stuff have to be registered. They also have to register with Meath County Council to get rid of their materials correctly. There's no point in giving a guy changing your oil three times a year, he ends up with a 5 gallon drum of oil. Where's that 5 gallon drum of oil going to end up? Because I know we're picking a lot of them up in County Meath.
Yeah.
But myself, Ashley, and our other colleague, Carl, we all pick them up on a daily, weekly basis.
And besides the fact that these are, I mean, you described the place where these tyres dumped as being, a scenic kind of spot. So besides the fact that they're an eyesore, they're also doing huge damage to the environment and to wildlife.
Absolutely. And like coming up to this time of the year, and again, we're going to urge businesses, householders, garages, everything, don't be given your tyres or any materials for bonfires.
Yeah.
Like burning a tyre alone, you're creating carbon monoxide, cyanide, sulfur dioxide, butadiene and styrene. It's what goes into the atmosphere. It's a very thick smoke. It stays in the atmosphere a long time. And if it starts to rain, it's going to land back down the ground. And then people wonder why they're sick. All them chemicals are coming back down to the ground at some stage.
Yeah.
And it's people that need to wake up and realise environment is first and foremost on everyone's tongue right now because of what we're paying for it, obviously.
Yeah.
You have carbon tax, you have fuel tax, you have all sorts of taxes. But like people need to wake up, and everyone can do their own little bit.
Mm.
And it's not just us, we leave it to the government and the big multinationals and the big factories. Everybody needs to do their bit.
Yeah. So we all have a responsibility.
We have to pass our environment to our next generation and their generation. That's... What's it going to be like in 200 years' time if everyone says, "Ash, I'm sick, it's someone else to look after it."
Yeah,
it's down to every individual to do it.
Yeah, that's really good advice. So we all have a responsibility to make sure that the stuff that we are getting rid of, we're getting rid of it correctly by passing it on to a registered operator. That's really good.
Social media pages, local groups and stuff like that.
Your neighbourhood WhatsApp group, etc. Now you're talking about.
Yeah, that as well. But I'm urging these buy and sell groups on social media, the administrators of them pages, to say, listen, there's going to be no advertising for picking up rubbish here unless you display a waste collection permit number that matches your name and your business. Otherwise, we're not putting the ad up.
Right, okay.
If they allow these ads to go up, man with a van picking up rubbish, where's the rubbish going to end up?
People don't seem to wake up to it. Yeah, that's a really good message to get out there, because I think, you know, we don't allow people into our houses, you know, who are coming to read meters, etc., without seeing their ID. So this is the same, exactly the same situation.
Yeah.
Alan, I think if my information is correct, which I'm sure it is, that you're also the dog warden, is that right, for County Meath?
One of them.
And am I correct in thinking, and this breaks my heart to even think about it, as somebody who is a dog owner or dog slave, well, no, I'm really more of a cat slave and a dog owner. But the problem of dumping, is that the right word? Or getting rid of your dogs?
I wouldn't say dumping. Well, we would say probably dumping. But look, at the whole of last year in 2021, we took in 217 dogs for the whole year.
Right.
This year, up until yesterday, we had 217 dogs. Out of that 217, 122 of them were strays. And we had 95 surrenders. And we're seeing this, and we're seeing it big time now, that people have gotten dogs during the COVID. They're sitting at home looking after this lovely little puppy. All of a sudden now people are going back to work and the dog is at home, or there's someone has emigrated and we'll fire the dog into the pound. It's not a huge feat to put it into the pound, and we'll get it in there and it'll be looked after. Now it is looked after, but it's heartbreaking for the staff in the pound, ourselves, for everyone that loves a dog, to see a dog that sometimes people have paid colossal money for, probably 10 times the value of a dog during COVID.
Yeah.
Like people were paying 2,000 euros for a dog that was worth 200.
Yeah.
Now all of a sudden we're seeing these dogs creeping into the pound and people are coming in, oh, I have to go back to work, I don't have time to look after us. Like we've a 9-year-old German Shepherd in there at the minute, and why we have a 9-year-old German Shepherd is beyond me. I'm a dog lover. A lot of people out there love their dogs. It's heartbreaking when a dog dies, but how somebody can actually surrender an elderly dog into a pound. Yeah. Now, the pound is fantastic. Pounds are not what they used to be. People will say, oh, pound is a dark little dungy hole of a place where a dog goes in and gets a needle. It doesn't. It doesn't happen anymore. It doesn't happen in our pound anyway.
Do you pass the dogs on, Alan, to rescues for rehoming?
Well, I can't praise Philip and Eleanor that work in the pound. I really can't praise them enough for what they do. Philip has such a huge, huge contacts of people with rescues and all over the country. Like, you could bring a dog into Philip and it's gone tomorrow.
Yeah.
And say, oh, God, Philip, you got the dog at home. Yeah, there was a rescue that helped us out with the dog. And it's heartbreaking to see it. But, like, people need to wake up. If you can't look after a child, don't get a dog.
Yeah, that's very good advice. Yeah.
Dogs are like kids. They're going to need the same attention as kids will need.
That's absolutely right.
So if you get your dog, do your research into the breed.
Yeah, and do your homework.
Research. And don't be afraid. We can answer questions. We're always on the phone. If you need a bit of advice or help, we can help you out.
Alan, I could talk to you all day. You're a fountain of wisdom and good advice. Listen, thank you so much for your time today and continued good luck in your role. Thanks.
Don't forget the biscuits are brought in.
I'll avoid it. That was Alan Nolan from Meath County Council. Thank you, Alan. And you're welcome back to Late Lunch. This is Barbara Scully. It's mid-autumn, and although I know that booksellers and publishers always talk about summer reads, I think it's now, this time of year, when I want to stock up on some really good books for the long, dark nights ahead. I love novels that you can really sink into and wrap around yourself like a warm blanket. So when I heard that writer Felicity Hayes McCoy's new book was called The Keepsake Quilters, I thought, that sounds like a perfect autumn winter read, and it is just that. I was lucky enough to get an advance copy, which I read during the summer, and I just thought it was great. But anyway, let's talk to Felicity, who joins us now. Hi, Felicity.
Hi, Barbara. Thank you for having me on.
Not at all. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Felicity, you're probably best known for your Finn Farren series of novels, which I know have been hugely successful and feature a local librarian and are set on a fictional peninsula, which may or may not bear a passing resemblance to your beloved Dingle Peninsula in County Kerry. But this new novel, The Keepsake Quilters, is a standalone. It's not part of that series. Was writing a standalone something you've wanted to do for a long time, or was this a story that you just couldn't get out of your head until you wrote it?
Well, do you know, I think it was both, Barbara. I mean, there are 7 Finn Farren novels so far, and another one due to come out in next year or the year after. I can't keep touch. I haven't written it yet, but I will write it any moment now. But The Keepsake Quilters it's a standalone, it's a generational family saga, and it was a book that kind of jumped out at me and demanded that I wrote it. And I got on to my publisher, my editor at the publishers, Ashet Ireland, who was expecting another Finn Farren. And I said, listen, here's the book and here's the idea and here's the name. And what would you say if I stood back from Finn Farren for a little while and wrote it? And I think the story and the title grabbed her as much as it had kind of grabbed me. And I mean, she came back and she said, oh, God, I really want to meet the Carson women. That's the family that it's about. Go on. Yeah, we'll put Finn Farren on hold and go write it. So that's what I did. And it's coming out at the end of October.
Fabulous. As I said, I was lucky enough to get an advance copy of the book over the summer. And I know I'm not just saying this because we know each other in real life, but it was one of my favourite books of the year. It would be in my top 5. One of the reasons I particularly liked it is a beautiful portrait of the relationship between 3 generations of women. It's a deeply feminine work, and one that I think captures the difficulties very often that mothers and daughters and grandmothers have, because they're actually quite similar. And that's a theme that you handle, I think, so beautifully in the book. Can you tell us a little bit, without giving away any spoilers, what the book is about, what the premise of the book is?
Well, as you say, it's 3 women in one family. And I suppose the sort of starting point character is Marguerite. She's the grandmother. She has spent a lot of her adult life over in London, married in London, but grew up in Wicklow, in a house in the Wicklow Hills. And she's recently widowed. She's decided to settle up in London and come back and retire into her old family house in Wicklow. Meanwhile, still over in London, there's her daughter, Val. And Val, in her time, was a single mum. And Val's daughter, Penny, is a very successful, a very thrusting career woman. She works in television production in London. She's an executive producer of a morning TV programme. And she's a totally organised woman. She has her life organised to the last inch. And what happens at the beginning of the story is we find that Penny is pregnant, unexpected pregnancy. She's not married. She needs to tell her mom and her gran about it, but she can't get her head around what's happening to her without feeling that everybody is telling her what to do, when she is the one who's always in charge. So basically what happens is, when she tells them about it in a cafe in London, they're trying to be helpful and nice. She finds they're being pushy. She kind of retreats into herself. And to keep Val from going mad, because Val was a single mum herself and she's really worried about her daughter, to keep her from going crazy while Penny gets her head around things, Marguerite comes up with the idea that she in Ireland, in Wicklow, and Val in London, because that's where Val lives, as Penny does, will together piece together bits of fabric from the past, you know, frocks that they made for themselves, their wedding dresses, things like that. And they'll make two sides of a cot quilt for the baby. And then they'll bind it together and it'll be a present for the baby. In the interim, it'll keep them busy. And at the end, it'll be a welcome keepsake for the baby, and Penny will know that the baby is wanted and loved.
I think so many of us will identify with that feeling of trying to help your adult children and knowing that in so doing, you're kind of coming across as, you know, being a little overbearing, and like as if, as you said, you're trying to boss them around when they want you to back off and leave them alone. And that was one of the things that I thought you captured so beautifully in it. But I know there were other things that were a general inspiration for you in this book, visits to museums and things like that. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? Because I'm always interested in where writers get their inspiration from.
Yeah, I think writers are too. You know, you kind of think, oh my God, where did that come from? Well, in the keepsake quilter's case, what happened was, I think I probably had a generational saga brewing at the back of my mind, but I didn't know who it was about or where it was about, or didn't have a starting point. And I was in the Crawford Gallery in Cork. And it happened because, like a lot of galleries, what they do is they don't have all of their paintings on the wall at one time, because they have more paintings than they have walls. So they have a kind of a cycle. And it happened that when I was down there, there was an exhibition of paintings which were done by Irish women artists or painters, paintings, portraits of women in Ireland, sort of around the 20s, 30s and 40s. And I was looking at these women in beautiful frocks. I mean, you know, velvets and satins and so god a style that you can imagine. And I was thinking, gorgeous portraits, gorgeous women. How interesting that these are Irish female artists that I knew about, actually, but I hadn't seen them gathered together in place, and they hadn't struck me so strongly before. And the two things, the idea of paintings, portraits, and the idea of what did those women wear when they weren't wearing their gorgeous frocks to be painted in, you know, and what happened to all those gorgeous frocks came together. And for me, they gave me, among other things, they gave me a storyline, because Marguerite in the book, her mom, who is dead, there's a portrait of her mom hanging on the wall in that family house in Wicklow. And there's a whole storyline tied into who that woman was and what the portrait is about and who painted it.
And her life. And repeating patterns is the other thing that I think you've captured very well, which I think you often see in families. The other thing that struck me is that your love of place. And I've referred to the fact that you split your life between London and Dingle in the Kerry, in the Gaeltacht on the Dingle Peninsula in Kerry. But your love of place is really strong. And your descriptions of London are, and now my geography of London's not brilliant, but around Borough Market are just so evocative. You know, you could hear and smell and see the busyness of Borough Market. It's clearly somewhere you really do love yourself.
I do. I adore it. I love marketplaces. I love city markets, you know, yeah, where you get traders who might have been working there for generations. Again, it's this whole idea of passing on of skills, passing on of family traditions. And near where I live in London, that's on the South Bank, and Borough Market is. And Borough Market is one of the oldest markets in London. I mean, if you think, think something like the English Market in Cork, you know, but it's yeah, huge, and it's under a gorgeous Victorian iron and glass roof, and it's crowded, and there's food, and there's beautiful smells. Basically, it's a food market. It has been since the 11th century.
Wow.
And that, that buzz, that food and shouts of people selling their wares and crowds, I just adore. And I also think it's very festive, you know, because the book ends... The book runs across the time of Penny's pregnancy, so it's, you know, roughly 9 months long, but obviously it goes back into the past and other people's stories, and her mom's story, Marguerite's story, and Penny's story all are told. They all emerge through the pieces of fabric. But it ends up in Christmas week, and it's in Penny's flat, which is over what was a junk shop in close to Borough Market, but is now an upcycling lifestyle shop. And so she's upstairs, and they literally, it ends on a Christmas lunch that that they bought from Borough Market.
Yes.
And the giving of the quilt as a present. And I just love that kind of tingly feeling you get when you're talking about going out to buy gorgeous food and, you know, and family celebrations.
But markets are very much about community, aren't they? They tend to be deeply rooted in the local community, and they're very much about communities of people. You know, I mean, if you've, and you know, it fascinates me as to why our capital city really doesn't have a decent market. You know, you've mentioned the English Market in Cork, and there's one, I think the one in Belfast is George's Street Market or George's Market.
I think so, yeah.
But
yeah,
there's, which is again, like you describe, half of it is food and beautiful, all kinds of food. And then the other half of it is craft and kind of handmade stuff. And it's absolutely fabulous. And in the city, we don't, in Dublin City, we don't actually have that, which, you know, we must be rare in Europe as a capital city not having a decent market.
I know. And, you know, one of the things that I'm sort of dealing with, one of the themes in the book is the idea of sustainability, the idea about growing local, eating local, small communities providing, you know, employment for their own communities, how that was much more the case in the past, but I think is actually coming back now. I mean, I have two characters in The Keepsake Quilters who are young. They're, they're, you know, 14-year-old and a 12-year-old, and they are terribly interested in sustainability. They're terribly aware of climate change. They're, and they're not, you know, geeks. They're totally ordinary kids. They're worrying about the sorts of things that kids are worried about these days. And interestingly to me, that was something that Penny was really struck by when she finds she's pregnant, hadn't intended to bring a child into the world, is bringing a child into the world. She starts becoming aware of issues that the child might be asking her about in 12 years' time or 14 years' time.
Yeah.
And these younger characters are there sort of, they're very teenagery, so they're not particularly laid back or friendly, but they absolutely are part of passing. If Marguerite and her mom are teaching Penny about the past, these younger kids are teaching Penny about what it's going to be like in the future. And I think it's going to be small, local, community focused, and very, very vibrant, very exciting, and very empowering. Enough. And all my books are about that. They're about the idea of empowering women and families and communities.
Yeah, yeah, I love it. There's so much in the book that I just, you know, as I was reading, I was like, yes, yes, yes. But the other thing which I want to ask you is, because the other character almost in the book is your descriptions of the various different fabrics, not just the stories that they contain, if you like, but the actual description. I could feel and I could see the fabrics, that the various different types of fabrics that you were describing. Are you a quilter yourself? Or a sewer? Are you handy with a needle and thread?
Well, I'm definitely not a quilter, and I worried about that at the beginning, and then I realised that I was writing a book about women who weren't quilters themselves, but who were doing this, but they were needlewomen. And I guess I, you know, my mum was a fantastically talented needlewoman. My sister Anne was a textile designer. My brother Ian was an architect, and he was always interested in how things were made. So the very first skirt I made when I was at college in the 70s with a black velvet maxi skirt, and I made it to a pattern Ian designed and cut out for me from pages of the Irish Times.
Wow.
So he used the Irish Times paper
to cut
the pattern out. And so I suppose there was always somebody in my family there, either making. With a needle, smocking like my mom, or with a sewing machine like my sister. And so that is part of my background. And I love fashion.
Uh-huh.
I love clothes.
Yeah.
Love them.
And come here, the fact that your book has focused on, well, you know, part of the book and the title of the book is about quilters. It has opened up a whole new world for you, because I believe that in advance of the publication of the book, that groups of quilters and needlewomen and various things like that want to come together in order to talk about the book while they're sewing away. Is that correct?
One of the joys of social media, if you're an author.
Yeah.
The book has a beautiful cover. It's a lovely, lovely festive cover. And when Hachette Ireland, my publishers, put it up on Instagram first, what started happening was people were sharing, you know, and putting it up on Reels and kind of getting in touch and things and saying how much they liked it. And then what started happening was quilters groups started contacting me. And the joy for me about this book, because it is about community and it's about local groups being able to come together and empower each other, and it's cross-generational. The joy for me was that they started saying, listen, this would be around the country, you know, rural places around the country, and they'd be saying, listen, we've got a local bookshop in our village or in our town, and if they're selling your book, would we get together with them? Would we organise something where you would come in and chat or talk or, you know, sign the books? And we'd bring in our quilting and we can sit around quilting and share stories. And for me, that is heaven.
It is. Yeah. No, I totally get that. And, you know, with your marketing hat on, Felicity, you're going to get some great content for social media. You'll get some lovely photos, nice anecdotes from that as well.
And indeed, if anyone listening here is a quilter or a bookshop owner and thinks this sounds like a great idea, I've been going around the country a bit and I'm trying to be there for people who are interested. And to me, that's the book happening in three dimensions.
Yes.
You see what I mean?
Yes,
and
yes.
And it's joyous before Christmas. It's lovely.
I know exactly what you mean. And I have a feeling there will be at least one local bookshop owner listening, because I'm going to be talking to her a little bit later on. So the Keepsake Quilters will be in shops when? In October?
It'll be in shops from the 20th of October.
Right.
And so you're right. It's a kind of a wintry book. It's a kind of a sit down and wrap yourself in a blanket kind of book, preferably a patchwork blanket.
Yes.
But it ends up in Christmas week, so it's a nice Christmas presenty kind of thing. I was very touched. Roisin Meany was one of the people who read it in advance and sort of gave quotes to the publishers. And she said, the perfect festive read.
Yes.
And I thought, well, you can't do better than that.
You can't. You absolutely can't.
It's there from the 20th of October.
Okay, that's great. And come here, so you're now, I know when writers like you, accomplished writers like you, you've got this baby which is about to be launched out into the world next month, and you'll have to do a lot of work, as you say, around that, getting it out and about. What are you working on right now? Are you working, are you not writing at the moment, or are you started on the next Finn Farren one yet?
Well, I'm plotting the next Finn Farren one, and one of the characters in Finn Farren is Fury O'Shea. He's a character that the readers tend to like a lot.
Yeah.
He's an elderly builder, which is a person that everybody has in their area.
if they're lucky, Felicity.
Well, now I wouldn't know how lucky you'd be with Fury, because he tells you how to do things. But he is essentially, you know, an incredibly warm-hearted person who really, really makes it his business to make things work for his community. And in this book, it's going to be the case that among the other storylines, because there's always a series of storylines because it's about a community, but Fury's storyline is going to be the time when, in fact, Fury couldn't help everybody else and it was everybody else who helped him.
Aww.
So in a sense, it's his book and his backstory and the vulnerable side of this very kind of...
Older man.
Yeah, he's in his late 70s. He's worked over in the sites in London and he's back now lording it at home.
Excellent. Felicity, it is always an absolute pleasure to talk to you. I wish you the best of success. This is a special book. It's the kind of book, and it doesn't happen very often, when I read it, I want to keep it. I don't want to pass it on or do anything with it, because I know I will go back to it again. I enjoyed it very, very much. So I hope you make it to this area here, to Louth and Meath, maybe to Drogheda with the book, to meet local quilters and needlewomen. because I'm sure you'll have great crack. Felicity, thanks so much for joining me today. That's Felicity Hayes McCoy, and her new book, which will be out in October, is called The Keepsake Quilters. It is published by Hachette. Don't go away. After the break, we've got another competition for you. And you're welcome back. Actually, just talking about books, I was delighted today when I looked at my Irish Times this morning to see that Roisin Ingle, columnist in the Irish Times, has mentioned my book. My book's called Wise Up, and it's about ageing, power, wisdom and the older woman. And Roisin's column today is called It Is the Age of the Crone and I Want Answers. And as I say, she talks about the fact that there are my book, among others, about how to reclaim yourself in your 50s and beyond. So that's nice. You know, it's the small things that you don't expect and you suddenly go, oh, that's really nice, and that make you smile. So if you've any things that happened to you today or recently that made you smile, and that people very often don't realise that doing those little things can actually really make somebody's day. So that really made my day. So I'm happy. I'm happy most of the time anyway. Anyway, one of the things that should make you happy is the fact that we have another giveaway for you, another competition. And this this time, wait till you hear this. Bellew's 10 Races, a two-day September festival, takes place on Wednesday the 28th and Thursday the 29th of September on the hill of Crocafatha in County Meath. And we have not one, not two, but we have three pairs of tickets to give away today for Wednesday the 28th at Bellew's 10. And Wednesday sees the return of Frankie Dettori, who's going to take on Willie Mullins in the Barney Curley Charity Cup Day. And that is in support of Direct Aid for Africa charity. So if you want to be in with a chance to win one of these, as I say, three pairs of tickets, what you've got to do is you've got to text the word Frankie along with your name and location to either text or WhatsApp to 086 1800 658, and we will announce the winners at the end of the show. We've got some comments here as well about biscuits. So you're all talking about biscuits, which is great. Tommy says he used to love Marietta and butter, but now it's gold grain. Tommy, I want to know, do you put the butter on the gold grain or gold grain better without the butter? Somebody else says Marietta biscuits are on sale in Super Value in Kings Court. That's great. I need to know where Garibaldi biscuits are. They're the ones that I can't find anywhere. Mary in Donore has mentioned coconut creams. Yeah, where are the coconut creams? We haven't seen those for a long time. And John in Drogheda says Polo biscuits. They were his favourite things. And then a caller from Navan says the biscuits with the icing on top. I remember those. I can see those, the biscuits with the icing on top, but I have no recollect. But they've iced fancies. No, they were cakes, weren't they? I've no idea what they were called. So if you know what those iced biscuits were called, do let us know. Anyway, I can see all you're all getting in touch now about the Bellew's 10 Races competition. If you want more details about Bellew's 10 Races, you can find all the details on bellewstownraces.com. I.E. Right, we're going to go to a break. And before we do, we're going to listen to some Anastasia. This is Left Alone. No, Let Outside Alone. Right, have you got a child in an exam year? I know it's only September, but I know already both students and their parents are thinking ahead, perhaps to next June, particularly if you've got somebody in Leaving Cert. So what about grinds and the demand for grinds and whether they're a good idea or a bad idea? In order to discuss this, I am joined on the line now by Irene Gahan of Academy Books in Southgate. Irene also runs the Drogheda Grinds Academy. And I'm also joined from Wicklow by Daniel Verveen. Daniel runs two grind schools in Wicklow Town and in Greystones called Exam Focus Ireland. Hello to you both. How are you?
Hi there, Barbara. Thanks for having
me on.
Hi,
Barbara.
Hello, Irene, and hello, Daniel. Irene, I'm going to come to you first, if I may, because yes. I think that you have already, and as I say, we're only a couple of weeks into the academic year, you have already noticed a big increase in the demand for grinds. Is that right?
Yeah, I think this is where the Drogheda Grinds Academy is now. We're going into our eighth year in Drogheda, so we've kind of built up quite a reputation. But generally in September, you know, there's not an awful lot of forethought. It's kind of when they get to January, it's like, okay, now the foot's on the floor and we have to go. But an awful lot more students seem to be taking them up in September, which in reality is better because you're not struggling or you're not panicking by the time you get to your kind of final run into June. But we're seeing a huge uptake in students this year. And I think a lot of it's down to a lot of them haven't done their junior cert, so they haven't sat an official state of exam, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But it's a much more, it is much, much better in the sense that they're planning it out. They're looking at their year. They're focusing on, okay, I'm going to do this now. I might not need anything in January. But there is quite a bit of an uptake. But there's always lots of different reasons for why there is an uptake. And I think, you know, when I talk to other grind schools, and Daniel and I would have this conversation as well, that there's lots of reasons why a student goes for grinds. And it can be, grinds can be quite controversial in some cases and in some ways. And it's always kind of, you know, those that said you should have grinds and those that are saying you shouldn't have grinds, you should be relying to the schools. The schools should be good enough. You don't need grinds. So I suppose there's kind of, that's always down then to my argument as to why a child should take grinds, or to why a child may need to hold off on grinds,
sure,
or yet should throw themselves into it.
Okay. Daniel, have you noticed a similar kind of busyness early in the year?
Yeah, we have. I'd echo everything Irene has said there. We're certainly have had an increase in numbers at the beginning of this year. Interestingly, we've noticed a significant increase in the number of boys joining early. So kind of end of August and early September. We're the same, similar to Irene, that we would offer a 37-week course, and we would encourage students to join as soon as possible, as early in the year as possible, because we endeavour to cover the full either junior cycle or senior cycle course in those 37 weeks. So it's an accelerated pace, but it ensures focus only on the most examinable material, the most important content. Our team of expert tutors and experienced tutors know what is most important and what's worth spending time on and what isn't, based on previous exam history and so on. So it's still acceptable for a student to join at any stage throughout the course, and the year is broken into three trimesters to help to facilitate that as kind of natural opportunities throughout the year. But to see the best results, we would always encourage joining as soon as possible.
Have you any insight, Daniel? You mentioned there that you're seeing an uptake in particular with boys. Is there any particular reason why boys have suddenly...
Yeah, no. I don't have any statistics or data other than our own, and other than anecdotal evidence, I suppose. I do a lot of mentoring and coaching with our students as well in our new study space facility that we have in Wicklow Town, where we try to focus and work on students' time management skills and their ability to start to develop and identify times in their week and in their schedule where they can be productive, they can set smart goals, they can go and then work on those goals and achieve them. And anecdotally, a lot of, particularly the boys that I would have had conversations with, will put their hands up straight away and say, I really didn't switch on enough during the online learning and the period of online learning. I was coasting a lot during maybe third year, fourth year, and even fifth year. And now all of a sudden, the reality of the Leaving Certificate is there right in front of them. And I wouldn't say that there's an air of hysteria or anything like that. But just a reality there, this is what has happened, and that they want to be proactive in trying to get back on track.
Sounds positive enough. Irene, I know that you have pointed to the fact that you think that schools are struggling to get teachers, and that might be one of the reasons why you're seeing an increase in demand. Is that right?
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, like we've been here 7 years now. So, you know, it's every term, every year you see a different kind of instance or a different kind of play. I mean, the biggest thing I've noticed is, I mean, we work with a lot of the local schools, so I would talk to a lot of principals.
Yeah.
They're finding it difficult to get teachers that might be on 11-hour contracts or 12-hour contracts, because it means a teacher has to maybe relocate. They're trying to find rent, they're trying to find accommodation. So they're not necessarily getting teachers for, say, subjects that might not have a big uptake, so like the likes of economics or tech graphics or DCG, that kind of thing. So they're struggling to get them. So there's a knock-on effect. Then you would obviously have to allow for, you know, sort of illnesses or maternity leaves, and they would get sub-teachers in as well. So there's a knock-on effect that goes with that. I mean, we have a few instances this year where students have gone into 50 year, not having any of the subjects that they actually want, and they're very determined. One of them wants to do languages, one of them wants to do science. The science kid has got no languages, and the language kid's got all science subjects.
Right.
So they're going to try and take them outside of school where they can, until the school can facilitate them. So I kind of feel hard. My heart goes out to principals trying to juggle this.
I suppose in an ideal world, we shouldn't need. I mean, I don't expect you to agree with this necessarily.
No,
it's your business, but we shouldn't really need to have grinds.
I know exactly you're going to say that. Yeah. I completely agree with you. In an ideal world, we shouldn't. But I mean, I had grinds 35 years ago for my leaving cert, and as sure as night follows day, it's going to happen in another 35. Yeah. I think. The problem, what I would say is, I mean, I originally set up the school because my son had dyslexia and he needed that extra, and he got a late diagnosis of dyslexia. So he was in secondary school. So he needed extra help. He needed extra focus. He needed extra time. And an awful lot of our students would be students who might be really, really strong in sort of say three subjects and then struggle at the other subjects.
Yeah.
So you're just helping them. It's not necessarily about getting an A. Sometimes a student C is another student. Students A, and we stream our classes as well. So, you know, it's kind of like if you want your H1, H2 in French, you go to that class.
Yeah.
Do you know that kind of way?
Yeah,
and it's very much about in an ideal world, every teacher would be absolutely perfect. Every school would facilitate every child. That's not going to happen, and it's never going to happen.
I think
we just provide the extra help where it's necessary.
But I do think, correct me if I'm wrong, but again, and I'm older than you, and I remember having grinds because I had one teacher who wasn't brilliant and was acknowledged as being not brilliant, and it was in order for us to kind of stay abreast of what was going on. A lot of us took a grind in French. But I mean, do you think that because grind schools are now so much more widely available that it causes parents to have a bit of a brain meltdown where they enroll their kids for like grinds in everything in order for them to get the maximum amount of points?
Yeah, and we're really against this.
Yeah.
Like we would have a maximum of three subjects in general
per child.
Junior cert subjects two.
Yeah,
we would rarely allow them to do three, and in leaving cert we would do three. And like if a student wants to do four, they might do an intensive day instead. But asking a student who's in fifth or sixth year to do an extra 4 hours, over an extra 4 hours tuition on top of that, it's a lot. And you also have to judge by the child. You know, if one child is just looking to stay up or to basically pass their leaving cert and get through it, obviously the supports are there. If another one's looking for H1s, H2s, you have to look at their mental health and their well-being. Mm. Well, how are they coping with everything else that's going on? And in some cases, it's kind of a case of sitting down with a student going, okay, you know, where are you at and how are you coping with everything else to see whether a child can even go for three subjects, because it is an extra and it's a lot of an extra ask.
Yeah. And you're happy enough to provide that advice to parents. Do you know, if parents wanted to contact you and explain the situation
absolutely.
For their child, and you'll be there to give them advice as to what you think they should do or shouldn't do, as the case may be.
Yeah, I mean, very much like Daniel, the service that he's providing, we will sit down with parents, we will sit down with students and go, look, if your child's doing seven honours subjects and you're looking to try and get them into another, there's got to be some give. And I always point out the points race is, it's crazy. Not every person is good at every single subject, regardless.
Mm.
Like you and I wouldn't be. I mean, I won't even talk to you about my maths, but my English and my French is actually pretty good.
And we
I
know
was
Louise.
Very lucky.
We know Louise can't bake, so. But I don't know if you do grinds in that. Anyway, listen.
Well, the thing is, not everyone's perfect. Not everyone's great at everything.
Everything.
So
yeah.
You have to balance it out.
That's true. That's good advice for life, Irene. Right there. Listen, I could have talked to you both for the rest of the afternoon because we all have stories about this and being parents and school and exams and all of the rest of it. But thank you both for taking the time. That's Irene Gahan from the Drogheda Grinds Academy and Daniel Verveen from Exam Focus Ireland in Wicklow. Thank you.
The Late Lunch Artist of the Week.
Artist of the Week.
Now, if you've been paying attention, you know that the artist of the week this week is Don McLean. In 1969, he recorded his first album, Tapestry, in Berkeley in California. The student riots were in full rage outside the studio as Don was inside singing the beautiful love song, And I Love You So. The album was first released by Media Arts and attracted good reviews and some limited commercial success, but it did succeed in transforming Don McLean from a rather unknown singer to an underground sensation. However, in 1973, Perry Como recorded And I Love You So and took it to the UK top five. It would actually be the last Perry Como song to chart. As I say, that was in 1973. It's a beautiful and it's a simple love song, and I love the first lines in particular. Again, I've referenced this a few times this week. Don McLean is a poet. Starts with, "And I love you so, and people ask me how I've lived till now, and I tell them I don't know." That's poetry, if nothing else is. Anyway, this is "And I Love You So."
"And I love you so."
You'd miss the slow set all the same, wouldn't you? Wouldn't it be lovely to be waltzing around your kitchen there with somebody holding tight to that? Anyway, stay with us. Coming up after the break, we are going to find out what pocket forests are. So picture this: a forest of birch, ash and alder trees, with holly and hazel bushes under the trees and wild garlic underfoot. A scene of natural, beautiful, organised chaos. A lone tree with bare soil underneath is not a natural state for a tree. Trees grow in communities of plants, collaborating with each other and creating networks in the soil and in the air. Doesn't that sound wonderful? Both of these descriptions come from the website of a company called Pocket Forests, who say that if you are surrounded by the grey concrete of urban landscapes, this vision of beautiful, organised natural chaos can actually become a reality, because Pocket Forests can make this dream, albeit on a reduced scale, come true. So to tell us more about this wonderful idea, I am now joined on the line by writer and self-described hankerer after the solace of nature, Catherine Cleary. Hiya, Catherine.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Good. Listen, your website says that you connect, the website of Pocket Forests says that you reconnect people with nature. How do you do that? What is a pocket forest?
Well, it's an idea that originated back in the 1970s in Japan, and it was a botanist who actually died only just last year. He was in his 90s when he died, and he loved, Japan is a very forested country. I think it's up to about 70% of the country is forested, compared to, a little over 10% of Ireland, and most of that is non-native. And obviously Japan is a very urban country as well, and a lot of people live in very densely populated cities. So he worked out a way that you could put what would be in an original forest that would grow naturally, if you chose the plants that would be there and you could put them, plant them very densely in city areas, you could almost create a pop-up version of a forest, and it would grow very quickly because of how the trees are planted and how the soil is treated. So really you're just opening up ground in an urban area and allowing what would happen naturally over, if you didn't mow it, trees would probably seed themselves, and over decades there would be a forest there eventually. You're just kind of fast-tracking that idea. So it was popular in Japan. It came through India, where the phrase tiny forest was coined by a car engineer who ended up working on one of these projects and falling in love with the idea. And then when we came across it back in 2020 during the first lockdown, we made contact with IVN, which is a Dutch environmental group, and they had just brought the concept to Europe and were finding that it worked brilliantly in Europe as well, because it's based on native plants. So wherever you do it, you use the native plants that would grow there naturally, as I say, if humans weren't there. So it's a great project.
So in order for you to set this up here, I presume you had to do quite a lot of advanced research into what are, because I think we've become confused as to what things are native to here and what things are not native to here, because we've so many other species of things growing here.
Yeah, and it's partly a result of, people loving that variety in gardens. Mm. And there's a lot of fashion, I suppose, in gardens as well. So garden centres like to give an offering that's different every season, and there can be trends a bit like fashion. Whereas actually our native plants are kind of Cinderella plants in a lot of ways. You might struggle to find them even in a lot of garden centres, because nurseries that grow them will typically be growing them for farms and large-scale planting. And there are a very small number of native plants, partly because we got cut off from the mainland of Europe so quickly, in comparison to other parts of the world. Say, for example, in India, there's something like 2,000 native trees and shrubs, whereas in Ireland, it would be fewer than 30. So, yeah, we had a lot of research to do because this isn't a method that's really used by foresters. They would plant for timber, so they would plant trees much further apart to allow them to grow into strong timber trees. And also, I suppose, what we really want to do is bring these ecosystems, which yeah. they are, because they're plants that work together, into people's neighbourhoods and areas where they can see them. Because a lot of the native forest that's going to be planted in the countryside, hopefully, is going to be very remote. It's not going to be really accessible to a lot of people. And we, you know, just relearning how beautiful these plants are, and then watching all the wildlife that flows into your garden or community area when you put in those plants, because they really do
okay.
bring the birds.
I'm going to come back to that in a moment because I want to talk more about that. But first of all, can you give us a kind of a pen picture, an outline as to how you go about if somebody wants to plant a pocket forest? Is there three stages that you have to do and how much work is involved and how long does it take?
Yeah, I mean, ideally, if you've got a lot of time, three stages. So you start by composting initially, because we do a lot of our work now is looking at the health of the soil before we plant the trees. What we're really trying to do is mimic what a forest floor would contain. So a forest floor would have lots of leaves and branches and yeah. organic matter that just falls and so mulched down. So there's no need for adding anything or watering anything. So we want to create
that
firstly. So we would do that, you know, and we've done great composting workshops with people as well, because we're realizing there's so much food waste happening if it's being composted and put back into the soil. It's a much healthier way yeah. to deal with it. And then we do a soil preparation where typically what we're working with is a grassy area, small grassy area that people aren't using for playing yeah. or, you know, picnicking on. And we're just trying to stop the grass from growing using very natural methods, all organic compostable materials, and usually a lot of waste. So we stock bike shops and get lots of cardboard bike boxes and things like
yeah.
that, because they're perfect for the mulching stage. And then we just let all the soil life do a lot of the work of aerating the soil and getting it, you know, nice and ready for the trees, which we plant in wintertime.
Right.
Because it's the healthiest time to be moving trees from a nursery when they're dormant.
And how long would it take from when you plant for it to, you know, to kind of mature, if you like, into this kind of ecosystem that might attract local wildlife and things like that?
Very quickly. I mean, I'm looking out at my own. I have a very small garden, so I have a small forest in mine which has 5 trees and 6 shrubs in it. And the tallest tree is the wild cherry, which I planted as a knee-high tree, I suppose, 19 months ago now, and it's now taller than I am. So, you know, quickly, and that's the nice thing working with schools, especially, where kids might get involved a transition year. By the time they're doing their leaving certs, the trees are as tall
well established
and established, and they've seen it happen quite quickly.
And what will come to live in your forest then, that perhaps wouldn't be there if it was just a lawn or a piece of grass?
Well, the birds love it, because they have, you know, they can be in the trees just hoovering around. I had a beautiful goldcrest hopping around my forest during the summer. I'd never had a bird that tiny before in my garden before. And it was just hopping from leaf to leaf, taking some of the insects that were around the trees. So the birds absolutely adore it. We've got a fox living in one of our school forests that the fox hole has been dug. You know, small mammals. You've got your mice, which you probably don't want in your house, but they're, you know, as long as they're staying outside in the garden.
Yeah.
I suppose in larger areas where they are there, you're going to have squirrels coming in as well as the trees get bigger. Yeah. Insects as well, and the soil life just explodes. You know, you've got earthworms.
It just makes your whole garden come alive. You know,
yeah.
from a kind of it's funny how our perceptions have changed. You know, as to how there used to be this thing of gardens being neat and tidy and organized and all of that, and now we're understanding our need for this. Do you need to have deep pockets, talking about pocket forests, in order to embark on something like this, be you in a school or at home?
Well, we've been very fortunate to get funding from the Department of Agriculture. They have a woodland support fund. So we are funded this year to do 20 of our smallest forests with
Great.
Schools and groups around the country. So we're able to come to, ideally, we can come to schools and say, you know, we have funding. Would you like a forest?
Yeah.
We have some private garden clients as well. So do get in touch with us if you'd like us to give you a price on that. And I mean, it's It's an investment, really. It's one of those things that you buy. I suppose when we buy things, they're brilliant, and then they kind of dwindle away on us. Whereas this, you buy something and it's quite small and modest, but actually every year it's going to
gets bigger and more exciting and more interesting.
Exactly.
Just if people do want to find out more, Catherine, they can go to your website, which is pocketforest.ie or .com.
Yeah, we're pocketforestplural.ie.
Brilliant, brilliant. Listen, I could talk all day. And as I say, that's really food for thought. I'm thinking now where I might be able to stick a pocket forest in my own garden. So look, thank you for taking the time to talk to us about that today. That is Catherine Cleary from Pocket Forests. And that's our lot for today. We're out of here. Thank you as usual to Louise. We're back here again at 1:30. Stay with LMFM because next up is Eddie with The Drive.
LMFM Podcasts with CNC Carpets. We bring the showroom to you. Or you can book a personal consultation at our fabulous new showroom in Moortown, Dromiskin. Call 087 66040 237 or visit our website at cnccarpets.com to book an appointment. CNC Carpets, for all your carpet and wood flooring needs.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.